Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, more and more, we rely on technologies and AI to optimize our personal and professional lives. After all, we are pretty bad at doing it ourselves. But if we're so poor at optimizing our lives, then surely it's inevitable that we end up baking our own biases into the programming that's supposed to be helping us. So how do we get around this? Well, Brian Christian is a visiting scholar at the University of California, Berkeley, and an author of The Alignment Problem, How Can Machines Learn Human Values? He joins us now. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Thank you.
The Alignment Problem, which is the title of the book, this alignment idea, it didn't start out in AI, did it?
No, in fact, that term has been borrowed by the computer science community from economics. And so economists going back to the 80s and 90s had been talking about, you know, how do you create a value aligned organization where everyone's pulling in the same direction? How do you align the incentives of your employees with, you know, the desires of the management? And I think this really gets to the heart of what's tricky about making AI systems do what we want, which is that we have to specify what we want in a numerical language. So a lot of AI systems use something that's called reinforcement learning, where you specify a way for the system to essentially earn points, and it figures out how to behave such that it gets as many points as possible. And this is really useful if you're doing something like, you know, you're trying to defeat the world chess champion or the world Go champion. It's a lot harder to translate that into, let's say, driving. How do you award points for, you know, allowing a safe following distance or recognizing that someone is trying to cross the street, et cetera? Suddenly it becomes very difficult to specify all of the norms and values and customs of what makes, you know, a safe driver.
Yeah.
In a language that the computer can actually understand.
It's how do you build in all of life into an AI? And you have a great example, actually. I was going to talk about, you know, training a computer to reduce, you know, if you had a supercomputer and you sat in front of it and you said, okay, give me a solution where we rid the planet of carbon emissions. And of course, the easiest way for a computer program to do that is to get rid of people. Right. So how you bake in the instructions is really important, which I think is kind of what your book is getting at. But you have a great example in that you talk about Joshua Gans. I think it's a lovely little actor.
Yeah. Well, and this points out that, you know, alignment problems are human problems too. So the University of Toronto economist Joshua Gans was potty training his children. And being an economist, he's very, you know, aware of the power of incentives. And so he gave an incentive of, I think, a piece of candy or a dollar or something to his older daughter for every time that she helped her younger sibling use the toilet. He later discovers that the older child has been force feeding gallons of water to her younger sibling in order to make them go to the bathroom as many times as possible so that she can get all these rewards. I think that's kind of a wonderfully recognizable failure mode of human incentives, which is that, you know, you don't always anticipate exactly what your incentives are incentivizing. And this is exactly what people are worried about with AI, right? So there have been many cases like this where, you know, I talk about a group of researchers at Stanford building a soccer playing robot, or football, I should say. And they give it a little bit of an incentive of, like, you know, one one-hundredth of a goal worth of imaginary points for every time it takes possession of the ball, because they want to incentivize it to learn that, you know, when you're in possession of the ball, that's good. That helps you, you know, earn points later. But the robot discovers that it's much easier to learn to just vibrate its paddle against the ball repeatedly, quote unquote, taking possession of it, you know, 100 times a second than it is to actually play the game. And so, you know, I think this just illustrates how difficult it can be to really specify what's in our head when we have some behavior that we want to incentivize.
And so when we're talking about something like, you know, academic research or, you know, figuring out how to get computers to play games, that's innocent enough. But in your book, I suppose you really show that we're using these systems now as if they're perfect and they're written well to align with society, but actually it's causing huge problems. Can you take us through some of the examples?
Yeah, I mean, you see this really across a wide spectrum of domains. So in criminal justice, certainly in the United States, and I think increasingly elsewhere, these quote-unquote risk assessment models are used that assign kind of a numerical score for how likely it is that someone will commit a crime if they're released from jail.
I need to stop you there. These actually being used, or are they being talked about being used, or were there pilots, or are these actually being used in law enforcement at the moment?
I can only speak from a U.S. perspective, but their use is actually mandatory in quite a number of U.S. states.
Wow.
So yeah, not only are they being used, but they're actually mandatory.
So what's the problem with that?
Well, there are many, but one that I would just highlight is that you can't actually measure crime. Most crimes that are committed never become known to the police. Many crimes that become known to the police don't get solved. People are wrongfully arrested, wrongfully convicted, etc. But that's the only data that an AI system has to go on. And so in effect, we have systems that are built not to predict crime as such, but to predict arrest. And when there are groups in society that are much more subject to, the police, then you create kind of a self-perpetuating feedback loop where the same people that are over-policed, that's kind of populating the data set that you have. And it says, oh, these are the people much more likely to run into the police later, which may be true, but it's not true for the reasons that we might suppose, right? So we refer to these things as predicting crime, but they're really just predicting arrest. And I think that's, one of many examples where you see the thing that we can measure, the thing that we can incentivize, becomes very subtly but critically unglued from the thing that we actually care about.
It's interesting that you say, we're not as quick at fixing these problems. Is that because we've already collected a huge amount of data that was already sort of reflective of this crappy society we live in, where women don't get paid the same amount, where black people are more likely to be arrested, and so on? Is the problem that we already have the data, and to go out and get the new data is hugely costly, so we're trying to fix the data that we have?
I think that's part of the problem. I think part of the problem is that these systems end up getting embedded into the very feedback loops that produce the data that they will then be trained on in the future. So, in statistics, there's this idea that's called IID, but it basically means, sequences of observations are independent. One doesn't affect the other. But once you have a machine learning system that's been trained on the past data, making the decisions about who gets hired or who gets released from prison, now it's caught up in a feedback loop. It's affecting its own future training data.
Yeah.
And so you've violated this assumption that everything is independent. And so you can create these kind of self-fulfilling prophecies.
And I'm right in saying that all of this, a lot of the data that was collected, it was easy to collect data in the earlier days of the internet. You could just, siphon off the information you got from Facebook. You could buy it from people. But now, because of protections, it's presumably much harder to get the data that you need. So is that a big issue, that getting data now is harder, so fixing this problem is not as easy?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of components. One is that, in some ways, I think the legal system hasn't quite properly wrapped its collective mind around the reality of the computer science. And so, for example, you see very well-intentioned privacy laws that forbid, let's say, engineers at Microsoft or wherever from knowing the race or the gender of, people in a database.
Right.
But then those same engineers are being asked by their managers to assure that there is no racial or gender bias in the model. And right. So how can they assess that, because they're prevented from even knowing that information? So there are ways in which I think the legal system is catching up to the reality of what we're learning from the computer science, which is, in many cases, you can only be fair with respect to that group difference if you do know who's in the group and not, because that's how you can kind of sanity check yourself.
Totally. And if you're trying to change society for good, it seems like you do need to tip the scales if you're going to use data as one of your tools to make future decisions.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, to your point about, you know, just grabbing things off the internet, I think there's been a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of people just grabbing available data sets without thinking critically about how those, where those data sets came from. So, you know, there's a memorable example in face recognition where there was a group of researchers in the late 2000s that, you know, sensibly at the time just scraped images from online newspapers and built this data set. And it was only much later that people analyzed.
Wait, hang on one second. I want to see what the problem is with that, if I can guess what you're about to say.
Yep.
So they took images from newspapers in the 2000s. 2000s. Now, is it just it was filled with famous people or?
Yes. Well, it turns out that, yeah, the people likely to appear on the front page of a newspaper are wildly unrepresentative of the population as a whole. And in fact, a later audit of this data set said that there were twice as many pictures of George W. Bush, then U.S. president, as there were of all Black women combined. Okay. Right. And so if you try to actually use this data set to do any sort of, you know, user facing thing, you know, you create a facial recognition system, unless you're careful, you've just created a George W. Bush recognition system.
I mean, it's funny, but it's hugely problematic.
Absolutely.
So how do you use a huge data set that's reflective, again, as I said, of this crappy society we have, and do better in the future? How do we fix that?
Yeah, I mean, there are several components. You know, one is just making sure that the data set actually represents the relevant, you know, aspects of the population. And this comes up both in these kind of gender and racial representation cases. It comes up surprisingly in self-driving cars. There was an Uber accident that killed a pedestrian. And the, you know, the analysis after the fact showed that their training data didn't have jaywalkers in it. And so the car was simply not expecting to encounter someone who wasn't at a crosswalk.
Right.
And so it's hard to sometimes anticipate all of these things, but we really do want the training data to be as representative of the world as possible. We also want to build systems ideally that are as transparent and interpretable as possible, such that we actually understand what relevant things are being used to make the decision. And so, for example, if you've got an object recognition system, there, for me, one of the most exciting areas in AI research right now is this transparency interpretability work. So if you've got an object recognition system, you want to ideally know what part of the image is relevant to the AI making a decision. And there have been some really interesting case studies here where, you know, you've got a system that is supposed to tell the difference between dogs and wolves. But when you give it an image, you see that it's actually looking at the background in order to determine whether there's snow, and rather than looking at the face. We've seen this in medicine, where there was a system designed to determine whether a skin lesion was malignant or not. And it worked, you know, 96% accuracy, as good as a human clinician. But when you use this interpretability work to see where in the image the AI system is fixating, it turns out that it's actually looking for the presence of a ruler next to the lesion, because medical images of cancer have a ruler next to the lesion for scale. Of course, this is useless in a real clinical setting. So that kind of work that can actually, as it were, sort of pop the hood and give us some insight into how the system is actually making decisions, I think is critical.
Yeah, because it's definitely the issue that came up when I had this conversation with another person about 5 years ago who had a book on AI, this black boxness of AI, where you put the data in, you get an answer out, but you don't know what happened in the middle. That is hugely problematic. So having sort of a glass hood, as you say, is a really good idea.
And we're making a lot of progress. So, I mean, hopefully the reputation of AI as a black box is one that will seem dated to like the last decade, but we'll see. There's a lot of really exciting work that's actually happening in that space.
the book is filled with lots of really interesting anecdotes of how things could go wrong and how we might fix them. Brian Christian is the author. It's called The Alignment Problem: How Can Machines Learn Human Values? Brian, thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm still laughing a bit at the economist who tried to incentivize his daughter to help his other daughter go to the bathroom. I have an issue with the younger one in my family eating his dinner. I must see what happens if I try and incentivize his older brother. If you have tried something like this as a parent and it has worked or not worked, do tell us your stories, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those in the podcast. Find it and subscribe for free in the News Talk app powered by Go Loud.